As commented on earlier by Dr. Grothy, a key recent clinical research initiative in colorectal cancer has been the analysis of the so-called ACCENT database, and during this year's ASCO meeting in Chicago, a great deal of new ACCENT data was presented by Dr. Dan Sargent and Dr. Mike O'Connell at a major oral plenary session focusing on colorectal cancer. I met with Dr. Sargent, a statistician who's been a key moving force in this project, to learn more about the findings, and he began by discussing the rationale for this initiative.
I've been someone who's been involved in clinical trials in colon cancer for about 10 years now. And coming to the realization, which I don't think took a whole long time, that waiting a long time for the results of a clinical trial is not something any of us want to do. We would rather be able to get our information sooner. And really, the genesis for three-year disease-free survival came from Dr. Amory Desgrammont, who proposed about back in 2002, 2003, based on more, I think, intuition and what he felt would be appropriate, that we could maybe look earlier. And so he actually held a meeting that he invited me to, and asked me to speak about disease-free survival as a possible endpoint. And as a statistician, I said, well, I can't talk about something without data. And so I took a look at the few trials we had done at Mayo and showed a little bit of a trend, but it wasn't convincing. And so then we started what we call the ACCENT group.
And when you say trend in terms of it correlating with overall survival.
Yeah, it correlated with overall survival. We only had about four trials within the North Central and the Mayo. And so that was promising, but certainly not definitive. And then we set out to get more data, more trials, more trialists, keep adding clinical trial after clinical trial until we ended up with what we call ACCENT, which is the Adjuvant Colon Cancer Endpoints Group, with 18 trials and 21,000 patients. And so it really grew very naturally, I would say. The people have been incredibly supportive and collaborative.
Where did the funding for this effort come from?
This is a project funded by the North Central Cancer Treatment Group, so it's NCI funded. We have never taken a dime of industry money for any of this work.
In this analysis, do you sort of enter each patient individually, or how does it sort of work?
Absolutely. We get the individual patient data from every patient randomized onto these trials. So we have baseline characteristics, age, performance status, et cetera, so that we can use all the patients in the model, as opposed to anytime you do an analysis, it's just based on the summaries. You're never really sure exactly, did they do the right analysis in the original publication? Do you have the right confidence intervals? That sort of thing.
It kind of reminds me of what Richard Pito has done in terms of the overview of, you know, breast cancer, mm-hmm. mainly to some extent prostate cancer. Is it pretty much the same process?
Well, it is, though what Pito and most people who've done meta-analyses in the past have looked at clinical outcomes. That is, let's pool together a bunch of clinical trials testing one treatment versus another treatment, whereas we have not looked at outcomes in that way in our trial. That is, we didn't pool together 21,000 patients to try to find a 1%
right,
difference
right.
for 5-FU leucovorin instead of 5-FU levamisole. So it was a different goal, but the similar process.
Yeah, just that, you know, my non-statistician understanding the way he's approached things, one of the unique things was to bring in each patient individually mm-hmm. as opposed to just, you know, taking 10 papers and sort of throwing everything together.
Absolutely. That paradigm we've certainly used from him.
And before we go on in terms of what happened, just to sort of bring us up to date in terms of ACCENT, do you see some of the more recent trials, the Oxali trials, et cetera, coming into ACCENT?
Absolutely. We have, as part of our group, Dr. Desgrammont, who's committed the MOSAIC trial, Dr. Walmark, who's committed the NSABP trial, Dr. Saltz, who's committed the CLGB-IFL trial, Dr. Van Cutsem, who's pledged the PETAC-3 trial, and Dr. Cassidy, who's pledged the X-ACT trial. And so that's our next major project, is bringing those five more modern trials, because at this point, the last trial we have in ACCENT completed in 1999. So getting that next generation of trials, first what we'll do is we'll see, does our model validate? Does three-year disease-free survival predict for five-year overall survival? I believe it may not.
Hmm.
And the reason is that patients now live longer after they recur.
Right.
In the patients in our data set, they lived approximately 1 year after they recurred. In the modern trials, as Amory presented yesterday, in Mosaic, patients are living 2 years after they recur. So what that says to me is that I'm expecting that three-year disease-free survival, if you look at comparing three-year disease-free to five-year overall survival, well, half of the people who've recurred at year three will still be alive at year five. So I think, consistent with what Amory showed yesterday, six-year overall survival or seven-year overall survival may now be the relevant endpoint for overall survival, because 5 years is not long-term anymore in colon cancer.
Interesting. It might be worthwhile, too, as we go through this conversation about endpoints, to refer back to Mosaic, because I think that the stepwise reporting of those data where the FDA approval came in really makes the point about how this whole thing works. And maybe this would be a good time to just sort of review that and sort of the history of the Mosaic, because it seems to me like the Mosaic trial has been the one that's carried this concept forward the most.
It is. The Mosaic trial was the first to propose three-year disease-free survival as its formal endpoint. And it really did that for two reasons. One was Amory's belief that three-year disease-free survival would correlate to five-year overall survival. But the other important element, and this has been considered by the FDA, is that disease-free survival in general is an endpoint that demonstrates clinical benefit in and of its own right, regardless of its correlation with OS, that there is a clinical benefit to patients to improve disease-free survival.
It's interesting, too, because maybe I throw in also the patient survey that we reported at this meeting that was mentioned in the Mosaic discussion yesterday, because, you know, it was this sort of survey thing and how much benefit you would want. And the older breast cancer surveys that we patterned this after actually asked patients about survival, you know, if you had a 1% improvement in survival. But what we put to them was recurrence, because we felt like a patient could relate more to having recurrent disease. And this kind of goes back. I remember breast cancer, they were arguing about this in the late 80s, before PETO did the meta-analysis. Is avoidance of recurrence in and of itself a reasonable endpoint from a clinical or human point of view? Any thoughts about that specific issue?
I honestly wouldn't specifically comment on that. What I can say is what the FDA has said, which is the FDA considered two questions when they met in 2004. The first one was, is disease-free survival and clinical benefit endpoint in and of itself? And the ODAC committee voted that it was. Second, they voted, is disease-free survival a surrogate for overall survival? They voted that it was as well. Though, in reality, from the FDA's terms, the second question is almost irrelevant once they've agreed on the first.
One of the things kind of being outside this that doesn't make too much sense to me is it seems like, you know, when you evaluate the benefit of an intervention, you have to consider the side effects and toxicity. And a lot of this thinking is based on chemotherapy and that it's going to be very toxic. But, I mean, if you can delay relapse with something that's relatively non-toxic, even if it doesn't have an effect on survival, it seemed like it would be something patients and docs would want.
I agree with you in the abstract. We don't have actually a drug that does that yet. I think the data I showed yesterday with 5-HU-leucovor and 5-HU-levamisole-based treatments, it's not delaying recurrence, it's actually preventing recurrence.
Right, right.
And it may well be that in an agent like bevacizumab, that instead of preventing recurrences, we delay a recurrence. And I think that question would then be maybe back to an ODAC-type body to say, okay, does preventing and delaying recurrences by 2 years make a difference to patients? As a cancer survivor myself, I would say I think that would be important.
What kind of cancer did you have, if you want to mention it?
Sure. I had Hodgkin's disease when I was 11 years old.
Wow, 11.
11, and I had a course of radiation therapy. I had a recurrence a year later and had a round of chemotherapy, and I've been cancer-free ever since.
What kind of chemotherapy?
It was a MOP-type regimen. It was a variation on MOP.
Wow. I mean, before we get back to colon cancer, I've just got to ask you, what was it like to go through that at that age?
I'm glad I went through it at that age compared to this age, because at 11 years old, I didn't have a sense of my own mortality.
Wow.
There was no question to me that I was going to get through this and was going to make it. I have children now, and I think about what it must have been like to my parents to go through this. And my parents were incredible. They never showed a single sign of weakness to me. But I know that once I went to bed at night, they had, you know, many, many difficult nights. And so for me, I was fortunate. I was treated at Mayo Clinic. and everything has gone great.
What was the chemotherapy like?
Chemotherapy was relatively toxic. Had a lot of vomiting, some diarrhea, a lot of fatigue, had to delay some cycles, but got through it. It was a full year. Had a lot of problems with neutropenia, so I remember it. That wasn't meaningful to me at the time, but I know that caused me some delays as well.
What was it like dealing with friends or family? Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, my brother was actually, in an odd way, somewhat jealous of me because I got so much attention. He was 9, and
wow.
I got, you know, all these people came and visited me. They brought me presents and flowers and candy, and he didn't get any of it, and so he was a little bit jealous. My friends were all very supportive. They helped me out at school. I remember I was playing football in 5th grade, and it was in the middle of the year that I had to quit because I was getting radiation therapy at the time, and they said, well, you can't be out there playing football. And so I quit playing football, but I stayed on the sidelines every game. And then the last game of the year, the last play of the year, they put me on the field. They just put a helmet on me and shoulder pads, and I went out on the field, and I just stood on the side, and they ran the play, and then afterwards, they all came over and, like, picked me up and
wow.
stuff. I mean, it was just outstanding. It was like a scene out of a movie almost.
That's wild. But where were you living?
In Rochester, Minnesota, actually, at the time.
Wow. So that's really fascinating. Did that kind of lead into your interest in cancer therapy?
I would have to say yes.
Seems like it.
You know, it's not like at 11 years old I said, I'm
right.
going to become a cancer doc, but it certainly piqued my interest, and all along that was something where I'd consider, you know, how can I do something? I think what it really made me do is I realized I had to do something that would help people, and I am a statistician, right? So I didn't go through medical training, but I knew because I do have a real interest and I guess some talent at numbers, but all along it was, how can I use that as a tool to actually help people instead of sitting in some ivory tower doing my academic work?
That's really an amazing story. When you think about it, I mean, you're just kind of getting started on a lot of these things, I'm sure. But, you know, just what has happened in terms of colon cancer in the last 4 years,
mm-hmm.
it's pretty impressive in terms of, you know, we can talk about the strategy of getting oxaliplatin to patients and the fact that fewer people now have been relapsing. And I guess if we had just continued to wait for survival, actually, we're not even quite there yet.
That's
right. Because yesterday, those numbers were still a little bit not quite under 0.05. I think it was 0.05 something.
0.057, that's right. So absolutely, I think that
it might still not be approved.
It may still not be approved today as opposed to being approved in 2004. I do think the data still suggests that in the long term, there will be eventually a significant overall survival benefit because there's still a difference in patients alive after relapse between the two arms in the clinical trial.
Let's talk a little bit, though, about the history of that trial and
mm-hmm.
how it sort of rolled out, because it was interesting in a number of respects. Maybe we can go back to the beginning when you showed that the 3-year disease-free survival would predict 5-year survival. Then it went to the FDA. But then at that point, one of the things that was kind of strange was that the FDA then decided to subset it out. And can you talk about what they did and why they did it and what you thought about it?
So Mosaic enrolled both stage 2 and stage 3 patients, 60% stage 3, 40% stage 2. When the preliminary results came out at the 3-year disease-free endpoint, there was an overall advantage for disease-free survival that was clearly significant in the stage 3 patients and was not significant in the stage 2 patients.
And what was the relative risk reduction in stage 2 and 3?
It was pretty similar between stage 3 and stage 2 patients.
In the 20% range, roughly?
Maybe a little less for stage 2. And then certainly when you looked at that high-risk subset, which
right.
was prospectively defined in Mosaic.
Is that right? It was prospective.
It was prospectively defined.
Was the looking at that specific subset part of the initial design?
I believe so. I wasn't part of the writing committee, but Amory has told me that that was prospectively defined as a high risk factors. They did that before they looked at the data.
Interesting. And they look sort of like the conventional
standard things.
Now, did they use number nodes?
You were a poor risk patient if you had less than 9 nodes.
But then what happened with the FDA? I guess it was presented as a trial in toto.
It was.
And then the FDA sort of cut it up.
It was, absolutely. And I think the challenge there that the FDA dealt with was there had never been a clinical trial that demonstrated that chemotherapy versus observation in stage 2 patients provided a benefit. Even though the QUASAR stage 2 trial has been presented in abstract form at ASCO, it still has not been published. So from the FDA's perspective, there's never been a trial demonstrating that chemotherapy improves over observation in stage 2. And so therefore, when they're presented with a trial of chemotherapy A, FOLFOX, versus chemotherapy B, 5-FU, leucovorin, showing a non-significant benefit in stage 2s, when they never had data showing anything benefit stage 2s, they said, we can't make an interpolation on something that we haven't seen in sense of 5-FU-based treatment versus control. So I think that's what the FDA's perspective was. You may know that Dr. Grothy and I wrote an editorial in the Journal of Clinical Oncology criticizing that decision.
Can you talk about sort of what you said?
Our feeling was that a fundamental paradigm of clinical trials is that in the absence of compelling data, the best result is the overall result. That's the result using all patients, and that's the result that's consistent with the design of the clinical trial and the prospectively designed analysis of that clinical trial. And so based on that paradigm and the fact that in MOSAIC, the relative risk reduction in stage 3 and stage 2 was very similar, and the formal test for what's called interaction was highly non-significant, meaning the data suggested that the benefit of treatment was the same in stage 3 as it was stage 2. We did not see any compelling reason to go against what we thought was a fundamental principle of clinical trials, which is you should use the result from the entire trial and only do subgroup analyses when they are strongly supported by the data with, for example, significant interaction testing, which was certainly not the case in MOSAIC.
And again, kind of getting back to breast, because I mean, I can always make Norm Wallmark apoplectic by bringing up this subject, because they do their trials the same way.
Yep.
But in breast cancer, we saw this whole issue of relative risk reduction that people eventually just bought into, and we extrapolated down to people at such low risk they hadn't even been studied, but we felt like the principle worked. Do you think the data that is out there right now in colon supports the same kind of relative risk reduction concept?
Well, the NSABP has done probably the best analysis of that, where they have looked at what's the relative effect of treatment versus control in each one of their studies in stage 3 and stage 2. And they showed that it's similar. So that's pretty compelling data to me, that the treatment effects that exist in stage 3 in relative benefits are probably similar to that exists in stage 2, does not change the fact that the absolute benefit is different.
Absolutely.
And so then it really gets to a question for the patient and a clinician to make that decision.
And I think that's why, you know, Peter Ravdin's Adjuvant Online website and Mayo has had a website also has been so popular to try to really figure out what the absolute benefit is. But again, there's also this issue of extrapolating down.
Yep. What I would like to do is to look at that high-risk subset in other trials, such as QUASAR, which did demonstrate overall benefit in stage 2 patients. They did not do subgroup analyses. And so I guess what I'm saying is I'm not comfortable saying I believe that adjuvant therapy benefits all stage 2 patients. I haven't seen data that convinces me of that.
What would you say an average risk or, quote, low risk, or patient without high-risk factors with stage 2, overall, what's the relapse rate?
Between 10 to 15%.
Okay, so 10 or 15%, where in breast cancer, they're getting treated, but
the best available data would suggest in stage 2 patients overall, there is some benefit of treatment. QUASAR showed that, and I think MOSAIC shows that as well. Whether you can further subdivide stage 2 patients into high risk and low risk, I think is still a matter of continued discussion.
So let's get back to the endpoints thing. And I also want to get into the sort of natural history time course thing that you presented yesterday, which was so interesting.
So the definitive demonstration of improvement in disease-free survival at an early time point at 3 years in 2003. 2005, we have confirmed that the disease-free survival benefit is maintained to 5 years. He did present some data on overall survival at that time point, but it was still not significant. But the very important piece of data he presented at that time was that patients in the FOLFOX arm, those patients, I think there was 7% of patients who had recurred that were still alive. In the 5-FU and leucovorin arm, there was 11.5% people recurred that were still alive. Now, we know, unfortunately, that those people still are going to die. And the reason for that difference is that the patients in 5-FU leucovorin got oxaliplatin after they recurred. So we had this difference in patients alive without recurrence that we could predict will turn eventually into a difference in overall survival as that difference is eliminated. And that's what happened presented yesterday. That is that the difference in overall survival between years 4 and then 5 and then out to 6 is continuing to increase as those patients are unfortunately dying after their relapses.
And they're also getting bevacizumab, cetuximab, or tons of other
everything else.
Let's talk a little bit about the data you presented on the time course of recurrence and kind of the key time points in colon cancer. Can you kind of review that? And
sure.
I have to say that's about where I started to get a little bit lost, okay. But maybe you can straighten me out.
Let's hope so. What we wanted to consider was, now that we're using the disease-free survival endpoint, how does that change how we look at a clinical trial? How does it change how we design a clinical trial? So first we looked at, how does adjuvant therapy provide a benefit? For overall survival, it provides a benefit that is consistent over time, that exists the first year, the second year, fifth year, and the eighth year, that patients who were treated have a reduced risk of death over a long period of time. We wondered if that was true for disease-free survival, since patients recur early. Patients die all the time, but they only recur early. And what we found was, perhaps not terribly surprising, that adjuvant therapy reduced the risk of recurrence early in a very substantial way. In the first year, it reduced the risk of recurrence in half. In the second year, it reduced the risk of recurrence by about 40%. And then that reduction in risk decreased over time, such that by fourth year, there was no significant difference in the recurrence rates between patients who were treated and not treated.
Although the recurrence rates were very low at that point.
Recurrence rates were low, but there was no significant difference between the two arms, and that could be due to events. But the estimate of the effect of treatment, even though there were few events, was continuing to diminish over time. That's not terribly surprising, because adjuvant therapy is only given for 6 months or 1 year. And so for it to have a lasting effect and prevent recurrences in year 3, in year 4, it's not necessarily a reasonable expectation that that might be expected. But what we found then was that this profound benefit in preventing early recurrences in the first 2 years translated into long-term overall survival benefit. So I think we now more fully understand the mechanism by which chemotherapy can provide the long-term survival benefit, and that is preventing the bolus of early recurrences that are going to happen in untreated patients.
You know, I'm thinking of some of the curves I've seen in breast cancer, which is kind of a more heterogeneous thing. For example, right now people break out ER-positive, ER-negative, HER2-positive, HER2-negative. Some of these people seem to have curves that look kind of like the colon curves, but the ER-positives have a completely different looking curve. Any thoughts about that?
We don't have ability to do subgroups like that. We don't have the markers that tell us which colon cancer patients are at different risks. When we look at it really by stage, there's similar patterns, and that's about all we can do in colon cancer. We would love to be able to generate some tools, and I think that's something that was alluded to several times in the discussion by Dr. O'Connell, for example.
Right.
With developing some tools that help us distinguish these patients better.
Yeah, I know Soon Pake's got a bunch of people in the basement down there cranking away genomic analyses, and I think they're working with Genomic Health,
Absolutely. Actually.
And
yep.
They've already reported some data, and it's going to be really exciting to see what they come up with. But Mike also presented some data from the ACCENT database, and that kind of ties into this whole thing. And can you kind of summarize what he said, and particularly the thing that he was talking about in terms of, is there a difference biologically between stage 2 and 3? Because that kind of confused me.
Okay, sure. So Mike looked at four factors, and the question of interest was, what predicts how long people live after they recur? He looked at how quickly the patient recurred, and patients who had a quick recurrence did poorly after their recurrence. That's not surprising at
right.
all.
We've seen
aggressive
yep.
cancers, early recurrence, you're not going to do well. He looked at the era, the time period that patients were treated, and what we found was very, comforting to us, and that is that patients treated on later clinical trials did better after they recurred. And that even happened comparing the era 1978 to 1985 to 1985 to 1992, before there was any irinotecan, oxaliplatin, anything else, that even between those two time periods, patients in the later time period did better after they recurred, which suggests that it wasn't just treatment that helped those patients, that it was improved imaging to detect the recurrences earlier. Mm. It was other improvements in supportive care or better possibly starting to have some ability to do a surgical resection in a patient after their recurrence.
Could it just be the selection of types of patients who are going on these studies?
Could be. Though we did do multivariate analysis and adjusted for age, for stage, and for other factors, and it still showed up as significant.
So that's still pretty intuitive. But then
still
he got
intuitive.
Into the stage thing.
But then the stage question, which is actually the most powerful prognostic factor for how long a patient lives after they recur, is what their initial stage was. And that patients who had an initial stage 2 disease had improvement in survival following their recurrence, there was a risk ratio of about 1.5. So it was a pretty powerful prognostic factor, rather, for how long patients would survive. So why does that relate to biology? Well, once a patient recurs, why should their initial disease status matter? They have recurrent disease. Well, what it suggests is that in a patient that has stage 2 disease, their recurrence actually acts differently than a stage 3 patient and their recurrence. And so that could just possibly be some selection effect going on there as well, though it's hard to see why imaging would pick up stage 2 recurrences better than it would pick up stage 3 recurrences. I don't think that's likely. I think what Mike was suggesting was that this suggests that stage 2 disease is somehow inherently less aggressive than stage 3 disease, that something happens when your disease goes to the nodes, becomes stage 3, that tumor becomes more aggressive, and that aggressiveness is translated into the recurrence.
Although it doesn't mean it's not lethal, which I assume
absolutely.
It is in each case. It's just a question of how long. I mean,
it is in each case, though in the stage 2 patients, 15% of patients were alive 6 years after their recurrence if you were stage 2. So there was a sizable subset of patients with initial stage 2 disease that had a good long-term outcome after their recurrence, which is clearly more than we would have expected.
What was seen in stage 3?
I don't have the exact number. It was on the order of 5%.
So it's kind of hard to figure out what's going on. I guess just biologically, we know that cancer is a heterogeneous disease that we just don't know how to classify yet.
Exactly.
Is that about as good as we can do to explain it?
That's about it. That's all I can say, yes.
Interesting. Getting back, though, to the issue of the time course, you then went, after you showed what you just described, and I guess the other thing that you showed, which was really a practical issue, is how few recurrences occur after, was it 5 years?
Right. After 5 years, it was less than 1.5% per year, and after 8 years, it was less than 0.5% per year in terms of patients who are still at risk who recurred.
These kinds of analyses, the one that you just described that Mike reported, particularly the correlation of stage with, you know, post-relapse survival, as well as the time course thing that you presented and the other part of that that we'll talk about, has this been done before in colon cancer? Has it been done at any cancers?
Well, in colon cancer, people have looked at this in individual trials, but these are pretty subtle issues, and within the context of any one trial, there's usually not enough data to really support a hypothesis one way or the other, which is why we've looked at this in the ACCENT. Some of these issues have definitely been looked at in other cancers. We know in breast cancer that there are late recurrences. I mean, that's been published. That's why breast cancer trials go out to 10 and 15 and 20 years, because
right.
There continue to be recurrences. There's been some recent work looking at the time course of adjuvant therapy benefit in breast cancer as well.
Right.
And I actually used one of those methods that was published by Dr. Engel in our analyses for the time course issue.
What about this issue of stage and post-relapse survival? Has that been looked at in colon cancer or any other cancers? I don't remember seeing that in breast.
To my knowledge, I have not seen that.
Hmm.
Interesting. So then you showed that, and of course the other issue that came out from a very practical point of view is the question of screening, follow-up, when a patient can sort of take a deep breath. And I mean, we've kind of known this before, but I don't know that I've seen quite so definitive data saying that, you know, you get out there to 5 to 8 years, you're in pretty good shape.
That is an issue that really does require a large pooled analysis, because by the very nature of what we demonstrated, which is there's so few recurrences, any one trial can't give an estimate of that. They'll give an estimate of that rate, and it'll be small, but the confidence interval will be large because there's few events. Whereas when we have 20,000 patients, we can actually, with some reliability, demonstrate that that rate is very, very low.
Up to that, I was doing pretty good, but then you got to the next part, and that's when I started to have some questions. Can you explain sort of where you went from there?
Sure. Being a statistician, I started to become nervous when I saw the findings from our first two questions that we've already discussed. And that is because our statistical methods really, in colon cancer and in most cancers, have been designed for an overall survival endpoint. That's just what was done in the past, looked at overall survival. And there were two critical assumptions that our statistical models use. First is that the risk of an event is constant over time, which is approximately true for overall survival, and we showed that. There's some peak early on, but more or less, you've got about a consistent risk of dying over time. The second is that the effect of treatment is consistent over time. That is, that if there's a treatment benefit year one, it's about the same benefit year two, year three, and year four, and year five. We just demonstrated that for disease-free survival, both of those are wrong. That the risk of a disease-free survival event is much higher early than it is later, and that the benefit of treatment is much larger early than it is later. So I got nervous and said, we're now doing trials with disease-free survival. Do we need to use different statistical methods? And I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but more or less what we did was we used the ACCENT database to consider what are the range of possibilities in colon cancer. Because we figured, what are the range of risks, what are the range of treatment benefits, what are the range of long-term outcomes that we've ever seen in colon cancer? And then we simulated thousands and thousands and thousands of trials, literally probably 100,000 clinical trials we simulated, using data, using parameters that spanned the whole range of anything that we'd seen. So we tried to create clinical trials that were like trials that have been done in the past, but varying all these different incarnations. So we would look at a trial that had a big treatment effect early on.
So these are theoretical
scenarios.
These
are theoretical
scenarios. So you say, okay, well, maybe the relapse rate will be decreased by X in year one, the death rate, all different kinds of combinations.
All different kind of combinations.
Combinations of impact on relapse and survival?
On relapse and survival, exactly.
Over time.
Over time.
Okay.
So we looked at every possible combination, and what we found was that none of those variations affected our statistical power by more than 2%, which was very reassuring, because what it said was we can still use standard approaches, because the standard approaches, even in these situations that are on the extremes of what's ever been seen, still work.
What do you mean by standard approaches?
The standard approaches that we all use when we design a clinical trials, which was we assume something called an exponential survival model. We assume we're going to analyze the data using a Cox proportional hazard regression or using a log rank testing. So the standard things that show up on every method slide before the clinical trials. We were afraid that we were going to have to go to different, more complicated approaches. Those actually are relatively simple and straightforward to a statistician. The more complicated approaches would have been extremely challenging to try to explain to practicing or even a research oncologist. Statisticians can understand them, but what I found in my 10 years is that I can dream up all the fancy statistical methods I want, but if I can't explain them to the clinicians that I'm working with, they're not going to accept them.
So what's the practical clinical implication of this?
So the practical clinical implication is that we can continue to use the approaches we have.
The statistical model.
The statistical model. We continue to use log rank tests, continue to use exponential power assumption, those are really the two key ones, and that we can use those approaches if our endpoint is disease-free survival and be comfortable that we're not doing the wrong thing. So what it says is, for those of us who design clinical trials, business as usual. Even though we switched our endpoint, we can continue to use the same methods, which is good to know.
I guess the other thing from a clinical point of view is, if you feel that survival is the key issue in adjuvant therapy, and maybe people have different points of view on that, is how do you interpret the fact that right now MOSAIC is not, quote, statistically significant? I mean, you still see a relative reduction on the curves look pretty mm-hmm. dramatic, but I guess it's not less than 0.05. So what's that mean?
Well, I think what it means is that long-term overall survival is still not able to be assessed. And the reason is the advances in treatment of patients who recur. And so I continue to believe that as MOSAIC gets to year 7 or year 8 even, that the unfortunate fact is that the vast majority of patients who recur still die. It's just that very wonderfully, they're now living 24 months or even 30 months in some reports. And so I feel in the future that 3-year disease-free survival may well continue to be the right endpoint for disease-free survival, but that it'll correlate with, for example, 7-year overall survival as opposed to 5 years.
What about 1 or 2 year disease-free survival? I mean, you saw these major changes. Why couldn't we just look at that?
Oh, absolutely. And we have a paper that's to appear in Journal of Clinical Oncology from Accent that suggests that 2-year disease-free survival is as good as 3-year disease-free survival. We intend to validate that in the new trials that we'll be adding to the Accent, because Accent was specified a hypothesis about 3 years. We have a protocol for Accent that says we will look at 3 years. The 2 years we looked at after that, and so 2 years looked very promising. Even 1 year, as you suggested, has a definite benefit to it, and that is there is no trial that has ever been positive for 5-year overall survival that was not positive at 1 year for disease-free survival.
Hmm.
And so 1 year disease-free survival may be an important negative predictor. That is, if you do not see a benefit in 1 year disease-free survival, give up. It's not going to turn into, it's never happened that a trial that was negative at 1 year turned positive for overall survival at 5 years.
What about a trial that showed a benefit at 1 year disease-free survival, but then sort of fell apart after that?
There are several examples of that. So it is not a reliable positive indicator. There are several trials that had a beneficial effect on early disease-free survival that did not translate into long-term overall survival. So at 1 year, it goes only one way. If it's negative, you can safely conclude that the overall result will be negative for overall survival.
The other question, I guess, would be, can we predict benefit even earlier and specifically at a metastatic disease? And I know that we probably don't really have the data to look at that, but I am curious about what your thoughts are about the adjuvant irinotecan trials, the you know, mm-hmm. PETAC and IFL, because that was kind of one example that stood out where what we thought happened in metastatic disease didn't get translated to the adjuvant setting. Any thoughts about what happened there?
Honestly, I don't. I think it's a very interesting circumstance. I think it certainly demonstrates that we need to do clinical trials in both settings, that we cannot necessarily translate the results. But I don't have a hypothesis as to why oxaliplatin and irinotecan, which look similar in the advanced disease setting, are quite different in the adjuvant setting.
And I'm not sure how many other examples are out there like that, certainly in breast cancer. And, you know, of course, a lot of things don't even get tested or haven't been tested, but it kind of undermined our whole concept of moving from metastatic disease to the adjuvant setting. Toxicity, I guess, could have been part of that, mm-hmm. and not getting full treatment. What about events? It seemed like there were plenty of events in the
Plenty of events. So the PETAC was actually larger than MOSAIC. PETAC was 3,300 patients, so they had plenty of events. They had more follow-up than MOSAIC had. I think there's little to suggest that there was any design flaw in PETAC that prevented it from detecting something that would have been useful.
There are a couple other sort of tangential mm-hmm. issues I wanted to ask you about. There's always this discussion about the number of nodes examined, and particularly in the stage 2 patients. And I just recently became aware of how common that is. I didn't realize that, and there were more data presented at this meeting. Peter Avdon actually had showed me this a couple months ago, that supposedly half the people in the United States who have stage 2 disease have less than 12 nodes examined.
That's right.
That's hard to believe.
That is hard to believe.
What's your take on what's going on? Because, like, in the NCCN centers, it's down, you know, close to 10% as opposed to 50%. What do you think's going on there?
The importance of 12 nodes has been known for a very long time. I was part of a paper in 2001, the Guidelines for Colon and Rectal Surgery that Heidi Nelson published in JNCI, very clearly indicated 12 nodes was the minimum acceptable standard. The debates that I've been involved in really center around how can we effectively, A, educate people as far as the importance of that, and B, discussions about actual consequences for failing to have 12 nodes. And there it always breaks down into the surgeon versus the pathologist.
Right.
Whose fault is it? And I think that was an interesting point that Dr. Sobrero made in his discussion yesterday.
Yeah, that was kind of funny, back and forth there. Yeah. Who's blaming who?
Exactly. So I think the data, though, is very strong and consistent that it's not only number, but it's also the percentage. And we actually published on that way back in 19...
That's in the node-positive patients.
In the node-positive patients.
The percent positivity.
Positivity that... I do think that's a very reasonable measure, because if someone only has 8 nodes, but 7 of them are positive, that patient's doing pretty poorly. And even if you have 15, there's a big difference between 3 positives and 10 positives out of 15.
Yeah, it's just a striking issue from the patient point of view. It really puts them into a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm.
Last thing I want to ask you about, sort of bringing back your experience with cancer personally, and kind of relates to Dr. Sobrero's discussion yesterday, because he actually came by our poster the day before, and he was asking about, you know, how we did it and what we saw, and, you know, this strange thing of, to me, strange that, you know, a third of people said they'd go through chemo again for a 1% mm-hmm. reduction in relapse rate. And, you know, it's interesting, and I really find it informative to talk to healthcare people in the healthcare field who've had cancer. Because it's hard for us on the outside to understand. You ask me, would I go through 6 months of chemotherapy to go from 50 to 49% relapse rate? It kind of just doesn't sound like something I'd want to do. And yet patients tell me, and doctors who become patients tell me, you just don't understand. Is this like an irrational fear that makes people do things that really don't add up risk-benefit-wise? What's your perspective on this, particularly having gone through the experience of getting chemotherapy?
I would be one of those people who'd say I'd do it for 1%.
Really?
And the reason is, the way I feel, and that's just a personal opinion and my feelings on it, is that I'm willing to undergo temporary discomfort for long-term benefit, particularly as a father. And I think if there is any possible thing I can do to be there to help my kids, I don't care if it's 0.1%, because I'll do it. That's the reason, is it's not for me. It's for my family and my loved ones. And so that's what it's all about. And I think that's maybe, if I was an individual, single person, didn't have any connections, I would feel very differently about it. I've only been a father for 5 years. I feel different now than I did before I had children. I think that's the big difference.
Yeah, I've been a father for a lot more than 5 years, and that's exactly what I thought. When I think about that thing and I go, you know, chemotherapy, all this stuff, no, I don't think so. But then, like you say, how do you live with the possibility from the point of view of your kids that you didn't do everything that you could?
You didn't do everything you could. So I will absorb temporary discomfort for what is a possible benefit to others.